Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Miami Marlins' new manager created a stir this week, but not because his team is winning. Ahead on Only a Game, the suspension of Ozzie Guillen and the protests over Guillen's pro-Castro comments. Also, the NHL finally puts its regular season on ice, and a conversation with legal thrillmeister turned baseball novelist, John Grisham. Also ahead, endurance athlete Matt Long retells the tale of taking his bike under a bus.
Now I talk to my doctors and there's nothing else they can say to me but that if I wasn't in the shape I was in, there's no way I would have been able to survive that insult. That's what they called an insult.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Tuesday, about 100 angry Miamians gathered outside Marlins Park to protest manager Ozzie Guillen's expressions of his apparent admiration for Fidel Castro in a recent Time magazine interview.
Every time we see Guillen, we are going to remember his words, loving, admiring. He can think the way he wants, but we have the right as well to say, no, Guillen, please go home.
Guillen was quoted in Time magazine's April 9th issue as saying, I love Fidel Castro, and that he respected the Cuban leader for his longevity. Later, he said he'd misspoken, but protester Steven Miro wasn't buying that.
Love and amor is the same thing. There's no way you could misconstrue that in English or in Spanish. He's been here long enough. He knows what he did wrong.
As the protest was in progress outside Marlins Park, Ozzie Guillen was holding a press conference inside the building.
You know what I mean? I don't blame those people to think what they think right now because they have all the right because I hurt a lot of people and I'm aware of that.
Before Tuesday's press conference, the Marlins suspended Guillen for 5 games. Under bench coach Joey Cora, the Marlins are 1-2. Guillen maintained that when he was speaking with the Time reporter, he had meant to express not love or admiration for Fidel Castro, but wonder that he had remained in power for so long, quote, when he had hurt so many people. And perhaps that is what he meant. Who knows? Over the years, there has been much confusion about what Ozzie Guillen has said and done and what he has meant. And perhaps that problem has been further complicated by Guillen's liberal use of alcohol, which Ozzie himself acknowledged recently. In any case, to his credit, this time around, the Marlins manager didn't blame his problems on the writer who'd interviewed him or on anything else. He took responsibility for saying something that he'd either never meant or now wishes he'd never said.
It's stupid, as you said. No, I don't say dumb because I'm not dumb. You don't have this job if you're dumb.
Even if Guillen is correct, many in Miami's Little Havana neighborhood, where sits the Marlins' gleaming new taxpayer-funded stadium, will be dismayed when Guillen returns to his job. But some members of Miami's Cuban community are prepared to move on, including El Nuevo Herald sports columnist Jorge Ibro, who's also a recent immigrant from Cuba.
I think this is going to be forget in the short term, but if Guillen continues being Guillen, that's another story. I think that eventually the fans want to see baseball and want to see the Marlins successful in the Little Havana.
Ozzie Guillen is scheduled to return to the bench Tuesday for the Marlins' home game against the Chicago Cubs. Last spring's Major League opening day rosters included 86 players from the Dominican Republic. Besides accounting for 10% of the population of the major leagues, players from the DR comprise 24% of the players in the minor leagues. So the system funneling players from the Dominican Republic must be working pretty well. Why would anybody want to change it? Joining me is Matthew Futterman, who has written about how Major League Baseball is trying to do just that. Matthew, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me aboard.
At the end of last season, Major League Baseball and the union produced a new collective bargaining agreement which, among other things, capped the amount teams can spend on international amateur free agents at about $3 million annually per team. Anything above that will incur a heavy tax. What effect is that likely to have on players in the Dominican Republic and beyond?
Well, I think what you see overall in terms of this strategy of Major League Baseball and that this is actually a part of is to bring down the sort of wild, unregulated spending on Dominican teenagers and to try and sort of bring some sort of semblance of order to the system so that you don't have teams spending millions and millions of dollars on a single promising 16-year-old who turns out to be 19, who isn't as good in actual competitive games as he might have looked in a few tryouts in front of scouts.
There's a committee currently exploring the possibility of extending the draft that now operates in the U.S., Canada, and Puerto Rico to the Dominican Republic and to Venezuela, among other places. How would that change the landscape for Major League Baseball and for players growing up in those places?
The great advantage that the Dominican players have is that they do nothing but play baseball under the eyes and under the management of the Major League Baseball teams from the time they're 16 years old when they get signed. Mm-hmm. So if you institute a draft and you're drafting 18-year-olds who aren't developing under professional coaching of Major League Baseball, you'll probably see a decline in the ability of these kids.
Would anybody in the Dominican Republic have anything to say about changes in the system, or would this be simply something that's imposed on them?
Oh, it's hugely controversial in the Dominican Republic. The trainers who are referred to as the Buscones, these are guys who their sole job really is to find kids who are promising when they're 10, 11, 12, and they make deals with them where they are responsible for training them. And then when these kids get signed, the Buscones get a cut of the bonus. So it can be very lucrative. If you put in a draft, you really essentially sort of knock the Buscones out of the system. They're the people that would really have the biggest problem with it because it's been a huge financial windfall. And there, but there have been some stories of these trainers who have really taken advantage of kids.
David Bernier, who is the head of the Puerto Rican Olympic Committee, has said that he'd like to see the Major League draft eliminated for kids in Puerto Rico. This development we're talking about would seem to be going in the other direction entirely.
It would be, right. That is not an uncommon sentiment among Puerto Rican baseball people. They really feel like bringing their kids into the draft has really done harm to baseball. It took away a whole business. It took away a whole incentive to get kids ready to be signed when they're 16 and then to be trained as professionals. And, they take a lot of pride in baseball and always have in Puerto Rico. And I think it hurts them to see other countries, the Dominican Republic mainly, but also Venezuela now sort of take their place as one of the main breeding grounds of talent.
What's your best guess about future opportunities in the major leagues for players coming out of the Dominican Republic?
I think they're still going to be there. I think the level of the bonuses are going to go down. I don't think they're going to have the riches that have been thrown at them in the past. And part of the reason is because the clubs will be able to make smarter decisions. And part of the reason is they may be subject to this draft and this limited amount of spending that's going to be available for each team.
Matthew Futterman has written about the relationship between Major League Baseball and the Dominican Republic for the Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me on.
The Saints and Hornets suddenly have more in common than just the Big Easy. Friday, Saints owner Tom Benson signed an agreement with the NBA to buy the Hornets. Meanwhile, the Saints are sorting out their staffing. With head coach Sean Payton about to begin his suspension, the team named an interim coach who can't take over right away because, wait for it, he's suspended. Joining me now is New Orleans Times-Picayune columnist Jeff Duncan. Jeff, let's start with the Hornets. Is Tom Benson's purchase of the NBA franchise going to be a popular move in New Orleans?
I think it will, Bill. I believe that most fans' biggest concern was the long-term security security of the team, that the team would stay in the New Orleans market. Tom Benson certainly is rooted here. He's a native. While there are some concerns, I think, how he's going to make this work with two operations in one town, I do think overall it's a very positive move and will be received very well.
The NBA took over the operations of the Hornets franchise in 2010 and traded superstar guard Chris Paul to the Clippers before the start of this season. Now the Hornets are the worst team in the Western Conference. Are fans upset?
I think fans understand that this is a transition period right now for the franchise with the NBA lockout last year, and then the fact that there was no owner in place is such an unprecedented situation. I think fans are being remarkably supportive. They had over 10,000 season tickets sold last year, which is remarkable. And I think the organization has done a good job of kind of making this a New Orleans team and not seen as a Charlotte team that moved to New Orleans.
The NFL levied unprecedented punishments against the Saints for the team's bounty program. Those punishments included a season-long suspension for head coach Sean Payton. That begins on Monday. Jeff, explain how assistant head coach and linebackers coach Joe Vitt can be the interim coach when he's also been suspended for six games.
They needed a strong leader, someone that knew Sean Payton's philosophy, and Joe Vitt is his right-hand man. They'll have to figure out how they're going to run the operation in those 6 weeks at the start of their season. But otherwise, Joe Vitt will be the guy in charge throughout this offseason and throughout the period of time after his suspension's up. So I think they looked at it as more of a big picture as opposed to worrying about those six games.
Jeff, we've talked about the suspended coaches, but Commissioner Goodell hasn't said anything yet about what players on the Saints might face penalties, and who knows what those penalties would be. Is there speculation down there in New Orleans about that?
I do think that the commissioner is going to be sensitive into keeping the football team competitive on the playing field. That's why I think eventually we're going to find out that there's going to be some fines involved with everyone involved. But the multiple game suspensions that a lot of people are predicting will probably just be reserved to the ringleaders of the bounty program, which will probably be the defensive captains, the authority figures in each group. And the interesting thing about that, Bill, is some of those players aren't with the team anymore. They might be on other teams in the league or out of the game altogether. So it'll be interesting to see how they mete out discipline for players that aren't with the Saints, because that could punish other teams. In a roundabout way, help the Saints.
Jeff Duncan is a columnist for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Jeff, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill.
Late yesterday afternoon, Joe Gavin and George Maloof, the owners of the Sacramento Kings, indicated that the stadium deal that would have kept the team in Sacramento was too expensive. The arrangement had called for a new $391 million building to open for the 2015-16 season. Whether the Kings will remain in the city under some other arrangement or relocate is uncertain. NBA Commissioner David Stern said yesterday that if the Maloofs had done the math earlier, quote, it could have saved a lot of angst and trouble. On next week's program, we'll address stadium issues, present and past. Maybe I'll get to recall the Polo Grounds, where I saw my first Major League game in 1956. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Clayton Price Baker had come with a plan. He went to the Masters, as lots of folks can, but Clayton Price Baker, you must understand, intended to leave old Augusta with sand. He had a small cup, which he dipped in a trap, but not with the care that he might have, the sap. So Clayton Price Baker, he got apprehended, and that's where his dream of Augusta sand ended. There's Dillinger, sure, and there's Bonnie and Clyde. There's pretty boy Floyd, who had some on his side, but only this Baker guy, cup in his hand, got pinched at the Masters for coveting sand. Will tales of his exploits be legend, you think? Or was he some clown who'd had too much to drink? I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a marathoner goes under the bus, literally, before he gets his chance in the big race. But first, the NHL playoffs begin on Wednesday, and there is serious Stanley Cup talk in Manhattan. The Rangers defeated the Ottawa Senators 4-2 on Thursday night and went up 1-0 in their opening round series. Here to discuss the Rangers' chances to capture the team's first chalice in 18 years is Jeff Klein of the New York Times. Jeff, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
John Tortorella, of course, is the head coach. He's gotten a lot of the credit for turning this team around. How's he done it?
Well, he has been at this now since he took over in the middle of 2009 season, and he is strict and constantly demanding of his players and is very grouchy and high-strung, but he is a master tactician, and he is a fiend for hard work and conditioning, and this Ranger team, they're a young group, and they have all come up together these last few years. They fight a lot, not in the playoffs, of course, but during the regular season, they led the league in fighting. And they've gone from being a playoff bubble team, which is what they've been traditionally for the last over a decade, to now the number one team in the East.
Are there particular key players we should be looking at this point to say, as these players go, so go the Rangers?
Yeah, I would pick out two. One is the captain, Ryan Callahan, who is a young guy from Rochester who's grown up in the Ranger organization, and he really does it all for that team. He leads most NHL forwards in blocking shots. He throws body checks all over the place. He's a little guy. He's lucky if he's 6 feet tall. And then, of course, the goalie, Henrik Lundqvist, who had his best season out of many fine seasons in the NHL, but he was probably the best goalie in the league this year. He is a suave, debonair, very cool guy. He is a terrific goalie who stays right in the goal line. He doesn't wander out of the net like some of the other fine goalies of the era do, like Tim Thomas, for example, or Pekka Rinne. He stays rooted to the goal line, and he stops 93% of the shots he faces.
New York is a busy sports town, of course. The Giants are Super Bowl champions. The Knicks have been thoroughly entertaining this year, though Linsanity has evaporated. The Jets awash in Tebow mania. The Mets and the Yankees in action again now. Are New York sports fans even noticing the Rangers?
A little bit, but you know, New York is no northern city. It is contrary to popular belief. And a lot of Canadians are always surprised to hear that the Rangers are well down on the radar in terms of where they stand in the local sporting firmament, because, of course, the team has been here since 1926, and it's an original six franchise and so on. But hockey, well, Jaromir Jagr once put it this way, after he had played here for a few years and then gone to Russia, he was asked, you know, what it was like to play in New York. And he said, well, hockey in New York is maybe the fifth most popular sport after baseball, football, basketball, and fishing. But I should say, on the other hand, I should also say that, you know, New York is, of course, a very, very big city. And the fan base that follows the Rangers, although it's not big in percentage terms, it is extremely avid, extremely knowledgeable. And the crowd at Madison Square Garden is as loud as any crowd in the sports and is very inspiring for the Rangers and very intimidating for visiting teams.
Game two of the Rangers-Senators series occurs tonight. What's your prediction for the Rangers going forward?
Well, I had predicted before the season started, as a lot of others did, that they would win this series in six, and I think they could go all the way to the final quite easily. They are not only physically ready, but mentally and kind of spiritually ready to advance.
Jeff Klein covers the Rangers for the New York Times. Jeff, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
The San Jose Sharks surprised the St. Louis Blues with a 3-2 double overtime win in Game 1 of their opening round series. The enigmatic Sharks have been the very picture of futility in playoffs past, having entered the postseason as a favorite 4 out of the last 5 seasons. Will the Sharks ever shed their image as a perennial postseason washout? Joining me to ponder that question is David Pollack of the San Jose Mercury News. David, the Sharks have not been short on talent in recent years, so what's been the missing ingredient?
They've gotten themselves, I think, a little bit past the total playoff choker image that they had for a while. In fact, they did reach the Western Conference Finals the last two seasons, but there was still always something missing, and they analyzed and they went into an offseason where they decided they had one too many top six forwards and one too few top-tier defensemen, made a couple trades with Minnesota to try to mix things up there, went to a more defense-oriented system than maybe they had in the past, and actually had a fairly disappointing season, where the regular season had kind of been a gimme for them for a long time, became a struggle, and they didn't actually get in the playoffs to the last weekend of that regular season.
Describe for me the hockey culture in San Jose.
It's really kind of interesting. I get into all 30 buildings over the course of a year, and I would say it is one of the best places, and I'm not a homer, believe me, but it's one of the best places to watch a game. It's a very energetic, very lively crowd that knows it's hockey. That said, it's not really a hockey city in the sense that I think San Jose is still waiting for its first hockey bar, for example, where people can go and congregate and a lot of memorabilia on the walls and know that on an off day they can watch Boston and Chicago play or something like that. So while it's really intense in the building, you don't really get a sense of it on the outside very much.
The Sharks are the West number 7 seed, and their opponent, the St. Louis Blues, are number 2 in the conference. San Jose usually enjoys a more favorable first-round matchup. Has that, I wonder, actually worked in the team's favor in this postseason?
The coach has talked about that. He thinks that it can work in their favor, and obviously one game into the playoffs, it has worked in their favor. Todd McClellan wants his team to play freer, and they can do that now. They really don't have the world's expectations on them. This is a different position for them to be in, and they found some success with it in the first game.
David Pollack covers the Sharks for the San Jose Mercury News. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
My understanding is that people don't read stuff on websites unless that stuff is accompanied by a great photo. So there's a great photo of Jimmy Svedek with the story about him that we've just posted on onlyagame.org. As a radio story, the tale of Jimmy, a retired Pittsburgh police detective who has long been operating a boxing gym, would have had to have been shorter. Shorter might have required me to leave out the boxer who shot his girlfriend, or Jimmy's poetry, or the stuffed pit bull. No way I was going to leave out those things, especially the stuffed pit bull. So visit onlyagame.org, settle back, and read about Jimmy Svedek, ex-detective, trainer, promoter of others as well as self, and poet. On Monday morning, an estimated 25,000 runners will line up in Hopkinton, Massachusetts for the 116th Boston Marathon. While a few thousand entries are reserved for charity runners, many in the starting corrals will have spent years training and improving their times just to be able to say they qualified for the world's oldest annual marathon. But only a game's Karen Given has the story of one qualifier who hasn't yet made it to the starting line.
So you go to Boston, you wear that jacket or your T-shirt or the hat, someone sees it, they go, "Where'd you qualify?" I want to make sure you didn't sneak in.
And you qualify.
And I qualify, so someday I'll do it.
I meet Matt Long at Starbucks, not in Boston, but in Manhattan, where in 2005 the then 39-year-old firefighter finished the New York City Marathon in 3:13, qualifying for Boston. Standing in line for our drinks, Matt looks to be the picture of health, bald but slightly tanned and undeniably physically fit. But as Matt makes his way to the corner of table I've snagged, the truth gets harder to hide. He wobbles when he walks. One leg is shorter than the other, and he has a cast on his left wrist, the result of an accident a few weeks earlier while training on his bicycle in Florida.
Lightning struck twice, but the bus didn't kill me. A Buick wasn't going to kill me. I laugh at things like this now.
It's a little jarring to meet someone who talks so casually about being hit by a 40,000-pound bus while riding his bike to work during a transit strike. But Matt's told the story more than a few times.
If people say I was hit by a bus, I was actually sucked under the wheels.
That is the appropriate sound that
you
would make.
When Matt was interviewed by Jon Stewart last summer, he mentioned the 68 units of blood doctors gave him during the first 10 or 11 hours after his accident. Some of the other details he left out. The bus broke every bone in Matt's left leg, shattered the right side of his pelvis and his right shoulder, and severed multiple arteries. The Daily Show audience cringed as Matt described how his bike seat tore him open, quote, like a can. It was more than a year after the accident when Runner's World executive editor Charles Butler met Matt for the first time.
Boy, that afternoon he was really thin. You know, it was a day sort of like today, kind of warm but cool for an April day. And but he had an overcoat on, even though it was springtime. And that's my first remembrance of him as just, you know, kind of unshaven but pleasant.
Matt was still on crutches when he and Butler first met, but that didn't last long. A year later, in the spring of 2008, Matt ran his first post-accident mile and immediately decided to train for and run the 2008 New York City Marathon. That November, less than 3 years after his accident, Matt finished those 26.2 miles in 7 hours and 21 minutes. Butler's 9,000-word article for Runner's World about Matt's marathon finish inspired more letters and emails than anything the magazine had ever produced. Eventually, Matt and Butler would turn the story into a book called The Long Run, a New York City firefighter's triumphant comeback from crash victim to elite athlete. But first, Matt had another surprise.
He called me up after he did it and said, "Hey, by the way, another footnote, I just did the Ironman," which was incredibly shocking. And he said, "Go check out the YouTube video. And if you see it, you're like, wow, that's pretty amazing."
I got him right here.
Unlike a marathon, the Ironman has a time limit. Finish in 17 hours and 1 second, and you don't get a medal. Matt finished in a little over 11 hours the summer before his accident. In that YouTube video, the crowd waits in the dark and goes crazy as post-accident Matt, clearly exhausted and in terrible pain, crosses the line with just under 2 minutes to spare.
You did it, buddy. You did it. You got this thing.
Pain is temporary. And you know, it's not just a slogan, it's not just a line that people use to push up, but pain in the athletic sense is temporary. I live with pain every day. But to push myself to the next level so that I can be who I was before my accident, it's worth it because mentally my life hasn't changed.
Back at that Starbucks, just blocks from the hospital where he was taken after his accident, Matt gives credit to the doctors who saved his life, the nurses who kept him going, and the physical therapists who pushed him to do more. But he says they all agree it was the running and biking and swimming he did before the bus ran him over that made the difference.
But my heart and my lungs were so trained from these endurance events that I did that they wouldn't stop. And they just kept working and It's not short of a miracle that I'm here.
The lingering effects of Matt's injuries forced him to give up his job as a firefighter. But he says sometimes the struggle isn't about overcoming adversity, it's about accepting it. So he's found a new way of helping his community. After the book came out, Matt's inbox was flooded by requests from people looking for inspiration. Now he often finds himself back in the hospital, visiting those in need.
For me, looking back, there were plenty of moments where I asked why me, why this happened to me. And now I don't. Now I know why. Because I was strong enough, fit enough to survive it and move on with my life. And now I'm hoping to send some of that strength to other people so they don't give up.
When Matt Long and Charles Butler first met, Matt was broken, not just physically, but psychologically. Butler says many of the conversations for the book were raw and emotional, as Matt struggled with his fears after the accident, that he might never walk without crutches, never find a woman to love, and never become a father. Now Butler says Matt has once again become the guy his friends remember from before the accident, the guy who can laugh off getting hit by a Buick.
I think that's his message when he goes out and talks and shows up at hospitals and does his thing. And he does it with a good smile, and he tells it as it is. He tells it like a guy from Brooklyn who had a rough day, but now he's, gosh, I mean, I think at one point he said he never thought he'd be married. Well, look at him now. He's married, and he's having a kid. That's pretty amazing.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
You're listening to Only a Game. College coaches and whole athletic departments often suggest self-sanctions before the NCAA can do the sanctioning for them. On Wednesday, the NCAA accepted as sufficient the self-sanctioning of Baylor women's basketball head coach Kim Mulkey and men's head basketball coach Scott Drew, both of whom have apparently been recruiting players more energetically than the many and tangled rules permit for several years. This would seem to be a very small deal if the men's team hadn't just won a school record 30 games and made it to the Elite Eight, and if the object of lots of Coach Mulkey's rule bending hadn't been Brittany Griner, who led Mulkey's team to an NCAA championship earlier this month. Penalties? Coach Mulkey will lose 2 of the 15 scholarships she'd had at her disposal. Coach Drew also lost scholarships, and he will be suspended for 2 games next season. The Baylor basketball programs have been put on probation for 3 years, which means not much unless somebody involved with one of them breaks the rules again and gets caught. It could have been worse. In fact, at Baylor, it has been a lot worse. 9 years ago, one of the players on the men's basketball team murdered a teammate, and then head coach Dave Bliss tried to engineer a cover-up based on portraying the dead player as a drug dealer. Self-sanctioning was not an option in that instance. In that context, the failure to abide by the NCAA's rules regarding phone calls, text messages, and casual meetings with potential players to discuss Baylor's advantages, academic and otherwise, is small potatoes. In a statement this week, Kim Mulkey said, "I believe strongly in following the NCAA rules and will always try to do so in the future." It will be easier for her to do so than it was when Mulkey's daughter and Brittany Griner were teammates on an AAU team. "Hey, Brittany, you want to come over to the house for cookies and milk after practice? You could ask my mom about the library at Baylor or the pool." I may be wrong, but in the lucrative and competitive business of college basketball, wherein the labor is not paid, but the coaches are paid plenty as long as they win, and wherein lots of university presidents have hitched their public relations programs to the NCAA tournament, and wherein violations that have been going on for years and sanctions proposed long ago do not become public until after all the nets have been cut down, it must be hard for a coach to keep from smirking when he or she says, "I believe strongly in following the rules."
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like pizza from Italy and cheddar from Australia. Locations at TraderJoe's.com. This is NPR.
Well, hello.
Deron Williams, currently a guard employed by the New Jersey Nets, will soon be a free agent. Regarding the possibility that Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, will sign Williams, Mikhail Prokhorov, the owner of the New Jersey Nets and a candidate to assume the presidency of Russia, said, "If he wins, I will crush him in a kickboxing throwdown." Mr. Cuban replied as follows, "He obviously didn't see me be the first in WWE history to put Sheamus on the mat. He knows not what he gets himself into." Which would be more exciting, Nets v. Dallas on the court or Maverick billionaire owner v. billionaire owner to whom the KGB answers in a steel cage? You decide. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, I asked John Grisham to approach the bench, I mean the microphone, to talk about his new baseball novel. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The New Orleans Saints have named assistant head coach Joe Vitt to the opening created by head coach Sean Payton's one-year suspension. One snag, however, Vitt's suspended for the first 6 games of the season as well, so I guess now we look forward to even more speculation on who will actually be coaching the team for those first 6 games.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be the offensive line coach, a guy named Aaron Cromer. Joe Vitt is sort of like the Mr. Wolf from Pulp Fiction of disturbed football franchises. He stepped in as the interim coach of the Rams in 2005. So he's becoming made quite a specialty of this. Unfortunately, he's entangled in the reason that the Saints are having tough times in the first place.
Alex Karras, former NFL All-Pro defensive tackle and the actor who was Webster's dad on TV, is the lead plaintiff for a new head injury lawsuit against the NFL. Karras and his fellow plaintiffs bring the total number of former players suing the league to more than 1,000. Will a celebrity on the docket help move resolution of these lawsuits along?
I don't have any idea, but the idea that there are 1,000 plaintiffs now should give you an indication, because I guarantee you that's only half as many players who could be suing. And before we leave Alex Karras, we should remember his most famous movie role,
mm-hmm.
which was as Mongo in Blazing Saddles.
Knocking out a horse.
Mongo, only pawn in Game of Life.
Having expressed or perhaps attempted to express admiration for or perhaps just wonder at Fidel Castro, and having been suspended for 5 games by his employer for doing so, Miami Marlins manager Ozzie Guillen apologized this week. He said, among other things, that his remarks were stupid, but that he's not dumb. Would you agree?
I would agree completely, and his remarks were stupid only in the sense of where he said them, not necessarily in what he said. I mean, what he said was both wrong. Castro is not lovable. Kind of stupid. You know, don't say you respect him in Miami, but absolutely true, which is that people have been trying to kill him for 60 years, and most of those people have been Americans.
Do you think Ozzie Guillen will still be managing the Marlins come the fall?
Yes, I do, because I think they've got a really good young team, and I think he's good at managing them, and I think if they've got a couple-game lead in their division by the end of August, we won't hear any more of this.
As nearly everybody must know by now, the Boston Red Sox will be celebrating the 100th anniversary of Fenway Park from now until at least the end of September. But apparently that celebration will lack the only manager who's led the team to a championship since World War I ended. Why is that?
Because Terry Francona is still angry at Red Sox management, and I don't blame him. On his way out the door, somebody in Red Sox management leaked a whole bunch of stuff to the Boston Globe that made Terry Francona look really bad. And he's decided that, no, bygones will not be bygones quite yet, and he's not going to show up. And I say God bless him for that.
The Los Angeles Dodgers played their home opener on Tuesday. There were reasons to rejoice. The Dodgers beat the Pirates, and the team will soon be rid of owner Frank McCourt.
Hoorah!
But there was something missing in that game.
Yes, Vin Scully missed his home opener for the second time in his 63 years. Slacker! All he does is take days off.
No mercy from Charlie for Vince.
I'm telling you, one day off every 31 and a half years? I'm not accepting this.
Saints owner Tom Benson has reportedly agreed to buy the New Orleans Hornets from the NBA for $338 million. The move would get the league out of a tricky situation, that being owning one of their own teams. But given the controversy the Saints are facing right now, I wonder, is Benson a good choice?
Yes, it is, number one, because he's not George Shinn, the used car dealer who's been running that franchise through the spin cycle for a long time. And second, now the Saints and the Hornets can do cross-promotion, and they can help each other out, and the Saints and the Hornets are now permanently in New Orleans, or at least as permanent as anything can be in professional sports. So I do think it's all around, it's a good deal.
One of the men who accused former Syracuse assistant basketball coach Bernie Fine of child sexual abuse has admitted that he lied. He says he was motivated by Syracuse beating Kansas for the 2003 NCAA championship. How will this impact the case of the two men suing head coach Jim Boeheim for defending Fine?
I don't have the faintest idea, but I have a feeling their case is probably going to fall apart. This Zach Tomaselli guy, who's now saying that he made the whole thing up, is, by the way, he was sentenced on Wednesday to 3 years and 3 months in prison for sexually abusing someone at a summer camp himself. This story, while you thought it couldn't get any tawdrier, is actually managing to do so.
I know who's performing badly already during this NHL playoff season, Charlie. Some guy named Tony Siracolo. Which team does he play for?
He plays for the National Hockey League. He's a linesman, and he did not whistle a play dead, and as a result, Danny Briere scored a goal. And Colin Campbell of the NHL has come out right and said, look, you know, we missed a call. It's a mistake. Not that they can do anything about it, but that's the way it goes.
Charlie, we have not spoken since last weekend, and therefore it's time for you to tip your cap to the new Masters champion.
I will tip my cap because the new Masters champion is noted for wearing caps, Bubba Watson, who says he's never taken a golf lesson in his life, which gives him something in common with me, went out and won the Masters last week in a playoff, and good for him.
On Wednesday, race car driver Al Unser Jr. acknowledged that he came out of retirement briefly in New Mexico last September. You think it's fair to assume that he wishes he'd stayed retired?
Well, it was one thing to come out of retirement. It was another thing to come out of retirement drunk, which apparently he did.
And not on the racetrack.
And not on the racetrack, exactly. Apparently he was racing another car in his Suburban and driving over 100 miles an hour. Don't Suburbans fall apart once you get past 70 miles an hour?
It's way too early to know if Kansas City will be an entertaining baseball team this season, but fans in Oakland sure are happy whenever the Royals come to town on a Tuesday, at least if they're inclined to sit in the right field bleachers.
Yeah, Jeff Francoeur of the Royals started chatting with the fans, and for some reason, and I don't know why they would do this, but I suspect alcohol might be involved, they asked him if he liked bacon. So he said, yeah, I really do like bacon. Apparently, one night, he wrapped a $100 bill around a baseball and threw it to these people, saying they go buy beer and bacon with the money. And this Wednesday, he surprised his fans by ordering them 20 pizzas that were delivered at the ballpark. This is the kind of stuff, of course, that probably makes Bud Selig frown, but which I love.
And finally, Charlie, the previous story notwithstanding, tell me of the wild claims of one Daniel L. Wan, psychology professor at Murray State University.
Gee, I was at Murray State this year. I should have dropped by to see Professor Wan, because he makes me feel really good about sitting on the couch and watching the Masters last weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, the stereotype that, you know, we're all essentially couch-ridden blobs is incorrect, according to Dr. Wan, author of a book, Sports Fans, The Psychology and Social Impact of Spectators. Sports fans are quite active physically, politically, and socially, he says, except, of course, when you give them $100 to buy bacon.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, among other places. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Throw down your plate. Pull up your seat. That sizzling meat just can't be beat. Oh, yeah. It's time for bacon. It's not time for salami. No. Or ham or sausage links. Yeah. Don't give me that old bologna.
No.
And olive oil really stinks.
So,
turn up the heat. Slam down.
John Grisham, the author of more than two dozen novels, including The Firm, The Last Juror, The Confession, and The Litigators, has at least temporarily abandoned the land of the three-piece suit and the billable hour and turned to baseball. His most recent novel is Calico Joe. The author joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. John Grisham, welcome to Only a Game.
Happy to be here.
Once you decided to write a novel starring a hitter, you didn't kid around. Calico Joe Castle begins his major league career with three consecutive home runs. Why were you going for the exceptionally unlikely at the outset?
Well, you want to read about somebody exceptional. You want to get the reader's attention. You want to tell a story that's never been told. You want to write about a player who never played. And to do that, you got to jazz it up a bit, you know. Baseball is a game of endless statistics. And it was great fun, messing around with some of those numbers.
Joe Castle's team is the 73 Chicago Cubs. By assigning the poor guy to the Cubs, were you trying to tip readers off that ultimately things wouldn't go well?
Yeah, I'm not sure why I did. I'm a Cardinals fan. I don't know why I picked the Cubs. No, you know, I always liked the Cubs. I grew up with Ernie Banks and Ron Santo and Ferguson Jenkins and Billy Williams and Don Kessinger and... I'm a diehard Cardinal fan, but I don't hate the Cubs like most Cardinal fans. I would love to see a World Series in Wrigley Field. It was fun picking a real team in a real pennant race. It's mainly about the Cubs and Mets in 1973, and the narrator starts the story 30 years later in 2003, and the story goes back and forth and back and forth as the drama's played out. But a lot of true characters, real ball players. And some fictional ones thrown in to kind of jazz it up.
You are, of course, the master of writing best-selling novels featuring lawyers. So it was being a baseball fan that led you to set a novel in baseball?
Yeah. Over the years, I have wanted to write two baseball novels, one for kids, one for adults. And I've just been waiting on the story. And in the meantime, I've written two novels about football and other, non legal type books. The older I get, the more anxious I get, the more curious I get about writing different, to see if I can write different kinds of books. I had no idea that my two baseball novels would come together in one story, and that's what happened with Calico Joe.
Well, let's get back to the story itself. Calico Joe is a preposterously successful rookie in a novel which also features a tense father-son relationship set in baseball and an old, large-hearted, small-town newspaper editor, and he remembers everything and is known to take a drink. Were you at all worried about cliches as you developed this novel?
I don't think about cliches. I think about the story. I think about the characters I want to tell the story, live the story. There's so many things I don't worry about or don't think about. I'm not here to deliver messages or sermons or give morality tales. I'm here to tell stories. I think that's my strength as a writer, is to tell a good story.
Were you a baseball player yourself, or were you writing from the outside?
No, I played baseball from the time I can remember, as a little boy, through Little League, through high school. I started for 2 years on my high school baseball team. Like all the kids on my street, we were going to play for the Cardinals. We all dreamed of being, you know, big league players. And growing up in Arkansas and Mississippi, where I'm from, every small town, every porch, every car, every kitchen had a radio. And if the Cardinals were playing, everybody knew the score. I can vividly recall playing Little League baseball, hot summer nights in Mississippi, and being able to hear three or four radios scattered around the bleachers with Harry Carey and Jack Buck and Mike Shannon calling the game, the Cardinals game. You would hear people start clapping or yelling or cheering in the bleachers, not for us on the field, but because the Cardinals had scored. It was such a way of life. The difference is, growing up in the Deep South, we didn't have access to the games. And as I've traveled around later in life and been lucky enough to write books and travel, especially to New York and other big cities, I'm so envious of the friends I've met who grew up, you know, at Fenway, at Wrigley, at Yankee Stadium, at watching the Baltimore Orioles, you know, the real players, the players I'd idolized and dreamed of.
Maybe for a writer, though, it was better to have all that transpiring at a distance so you could imagine it.
There's a magic in radio that it's a lost art now. I love still to listen to a baseball game, especially a college football game, on the radio, because the really good announcers can bring it to life, and it's what you don't see. You know, the roar of the crowd, the crack of the bat, and you can just envision what it was like being there. My first memory as a child, I was probably 5 or 6 years old, is sitting on the front porch of my grandparents' home in the cotton fields of Arkansas, late at night, hot summertime, with my father and grandfather arguing about Stan Musial. While the game was on the radio, my mother and grandmother shelling butter beans, and I was a little boy sitting on the steps listening to the crowd from St. Louis, which was a million miles away.
In an author's note at the end of the book, you bring up what you call baseball's code. Tell me what that code is as you understand it and how important it is to the novel.
Primarily, it's about when do you throw at a batter and when do you not throw at a batter. Every team handles it differently, but there are times in many games where a batter gets hit for no apparent reason or for an obvious reason. And then the question becomes, do you retaliate? How do you retaliate? Who do you hit in retaliation? Where do you hit them? And what might it mean to the outcome of the game? There are times, though, when a batter knows he's got it coming. Maybe the last time up he hit a home run, you know, maybe he overdid the celebration. So especially in the old days. Nowadays, they do so much hot dogging, you can't even, you know, everybody does it now. I would always say I would love to see Barry Bonds hit a home run off of Bob Gibson. And you know, just see how long he would stand at the plate, you know, see if he would do all that hot dogging.
And watching
he'd
it
probably
go out.
Duck his head and sprint around the bases, okay, and hurry back to the dugout, because nobody did that with Bob Gibson.
Perhaps I shouldn't have to ask, given your track record with the movies, but have you sold the film rights to Calico Joe for millions of dollars yet?
Not for millions, and no, we have not sold the film rights. The book was just published And it, typically when a book comes out, you know, it's seen by a lot of people who make movies, and there are a lot of phone calls, and the phone calls eventually die out and go away. And if somebody's serious about it, they'll hang around, and then we'll get serious. I've learned not to get in a hurry with the film adaptations. It's very difficult to get a movie made these days as opposed to 20 years ago when it was almost automatic, it seemed like. But we have some very strong interest from a couple of really good people right now that who want to do the movie. I tell people all the time with movies, don't believe you're ever going to see the movie until – I don't care how many contracts have been signed, how many promises have been made – until they start filming, because at that point, somebody's put down some serious cash and there's going to be a movie. So I'll believe it when I see it.
John Grisham is the author of a score of bestsellers, and his most recent novel is Calico Joe, published by Doubleday. The author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. John Grisham, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
How would you like a copy of John Grisham's new baseball novel? Visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/onlyagameradio. Like the page, then click like on our post about my interview with John Grisham. We'll choose 5 lucky winners to receive a copy of Calico Joe. Visit facebook.com/onlyagameradio. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jeremy Conlin. Special thanks this week to reporter Phil Latzman at WLRN in Miami. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen's photo gallery, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from John Grisham, who discloses the title of his next novel.
Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers.
It's the tale of a young man unfairly accused of agricultural theft in the Deep South and the heroic public defender who struggles to clear his name. No, I'm just kidding. That was just a microphone check. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. And the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.